So I'm not here to talk about or to convince you about getting rid of your phone. Our phones are totally here to stay. It's about using your phone and all of your technologies more mindfully. And when we do, conversation is there to reclaim.
Welcome to Harvard Square and Cambridge Forum. Tonight we're confronting how to reclaim real conversation in our digital age with MIT professor Sherry Turkle. Most of us own at least one of these intrusive little objects that some of us can't live or even sleep without, the cell phone. With the help of our guest, renowned media scholar, MIT professor Sherry Turkle, we will be investigating the gradual death of talk, not chatter, in today's digital culture, and considering how we might rescue this unique human gift before it's too late. Professor Turkle has spent over 30 years studying the psychology of people's relationship with technology. Over that period, she has authored 5 books. 3 of these publications formed a trilogy about our relationship with digital technology: The Second Self, Life on the Screen, and Alone Together. Turkle's new book, Reclaiming Conversation, goes even further. It's a great honor to welcome Professor Sherry Turkle to tonight's Cambridge Forum.
Thank you so much. You know, we kind of are smitten with our devices in business, at home, in school, and we're using them, sometimes without meaning to take us away from face-to-face conversation. But we are also at a very curious and complicated moment. My story tonight is not a simple story, because we're doing something and don't feel completely comfortable about what we're doing. We're doing something and we don't feel good about it. Here's a remarkable statistic. 89% of Americans say that during their last social interaction, they took out their phone. They took out their phone to take a call, to make a text, to check something. You know, just in the middle of the conversation, they did that. And 82% say that it reduced the quality of the conversation. So 89% say they did something, 82% say that it deteriorated the quality of the conversation we're in. So that's what I found too. You know, we're at a moment when we know we're doing something that's not quite in our best interest. And in 5 years of research, looking at business, families, education, and love, I found people talking about losing something that they weren't really ready to lose. I mean, that's kind of the sum up of what reclaiming conversation says. People in conflict, people saying, I'm losing something I'm not quite ready to lose. So I ended up writing an optimistic book of sort of people, you know, losing something they're not quite ready to lose, and then saying, well, you know, how can I turn this around? As opposed to a pessimistic book of, well, I'm losing something I'm not quite ready to lose, and what's the next step in losing it? People really are at a moment when I think they can reclaim conversation, which is my shorthand way of saying that people are ready to do something. And so Reclaiming Conversation turned out to be a very hopeful book. I think we're at a turning point, at home, in education, in friendship. But a turning point doesn't mean you don't have to do anything. A turning point means you're gonna have to mobilize and pull your socks up. And let me just give examples before I step back to the big picture. Examples of people who are ready to make a change. So I'm interviewing a man who has 2 daughters. One is now 11, and one is 2. And he talks to me about how when his 11-year-old was 2, he used to give her a bath every night, and when he would give her a bath, his greatest pleasure was the conversations he would have with her during that bath time. And he's convinced that it was those conversations that form the kind of bedrock of his relationship with her now. Playing with the little you know, little guys she had in her bathtub, making up stories, hearing about her day at school. That's what their relationship was based on. And then he says, now I put my two-year-old in the bathtub. I make sure the water isn't too hot. I make sure it's not too high. I make sure she's safe. I sit down on the toilet seat. I put the toilet seat down. I sit down. I take up my iPhone, and I do my email. And he says, I don't have any conversations with her. And then he just kind of was listening to himself tell this story, getting more and more uncomfortable and unhappy with the story he's telling about his parenting. It was a very, very poignant moment. I know that man, he's part of the 89% who takes out his phone and the 82% who feels it's deteriorating his interactions with his family. So that's the story about home. Let me talk about friendship. And again, somebody who's ready to change in friendship. I talked to an 18-year-old about her friendships, and she tells me that she thinks that there's a 7-minute rule in conversation. And I say, well, what's a 7-minute rule in conversation? And she explains to me, and I thought she was so wise, that it takes 7 minutes when you're talking to somebody to figure out if it's going to be interesting to you, if it's going to be worth your time. Because it takes that long to, you know, to get used to them and get used to their body and how they talk and how they express themselves and how it's going to go and to kind of let the conversation take a few tangents. It takes 7 minutes. It's like it takes 7 minutes probably for you to figure out if you're glad you came. It's not just a 7-minute rule. So I hear this 18-year-old say this and I think, my God, what a wise woman. And then she says to me, but I don't follow it. I find that I after just a couple of minutes, I take out my phone and start looking at my mail. So I don't have enough patience to follow the 7-minute rule. I know I need to put in my 7 minutes, but I don't have enough patience for that. I get bored. As soon as it gets boring, as soon as there's a lull, I take out my phone, I leave the conversation. And that theme of not having the patience to sit out what this woman called the lulls, of thinking that sort of life should be like the scroll on the bottom of a screen, you're sort of always stimulating, always there, always exciting, you know, always there for you in some new exciting way. Not having patience for those 7 minutes where you kind of get used to thinking, is this worth it? That was really a major theme of what I found when I studied conversation, that we're not willing to give each other that kind of time. We are so used to the edited life. Online, we can control our time. We can multitask. We can edit ourselves to get things right. We can retouch. As one young man put it to me, he said, conversation, I'll tell you what's wrong with conversation. It takes place in real time, and you can't control what you're going to say. That's exactly what is wrong with conversation. But that's exactly what's right with conversation. And then the question is, are we at a moment when we think that's exactly what's wrong with conversation, or do we think that's exactly what's right with conversation? But our fear of that right now, and I can certainly report that right now there is a fear of that, leads to a flight from conversation, at least from a certain kind of conversation that's open-ended, that's spontaneous, conversation in which we play with ideas, in which we allow ourselves to be fully present and vulnerable. Yet these are the kinds of conversations, as I said, where empathy flourishes, where intimacy flourishes, where we're most ourselves, distracted at our dinner tables and in our living rooms, in our business meetings, in our classrooms. I think we're finding traces of what I'd call a new silent spring, which is the wonderful phrase that Rachel Carson used when we were ready to see that with technological change had come an assault on our environment. And now we've really reached another moment of assault. Another moment of recognition, and this time, technology is implicated in an assault on empathy. So, why do I say I wrote a good news book? Is because there is good news. There's tons of good news. We are very resilient. In one study, in only 5 days at a sleepaway camp where there were no devices, and there are many such camps, the empathy levels that had been depressed in kids when they arrived at the camp began to rise, and children began to relearn the ability, in other words, to identify and identify with the feelings of others. Now, how did that happen? It's because they talked to each other. That's why I call conversation the talking cure. They talked to each other. We are the empathy app. We are the empathy app. Face-to-face conversation is the most human and humanizing thing that we do. So I'm not here to talk about or to convince you about giving up your phone, getting rid of your phone. Our phones are totally here to stay. I personally love my phone. It's about using your phone and all of your technologies more mindfully. And when we do, conversation is there to reclaim for the failing connections of our digital world. And we do have failing connections in our digital world. Conversation is the talking cure. Now, in my book, Reclaiming Conversation, I talk about a thinker who many people would never think of in the context of conversation because they think of him as somebody who tried to get away from it all, and that's Henry David Thoreau. And I love using Thoreau to talk about conversation. First of all, because people say, what, Thoreau, conversation, what about, I mean, what? And it turns out that he was a tremendous conversationalist, and in fact, in Walden, he talks about, he has a wonderful metaphor. He says, in my cabin, he had three chairs, and one chair was for solitude, two chairs were for friendship, and three were for society. And this metaphor of the three chairs, I love it because it describes a virtuous circle that, for me, links the capacity to be alone with the capacity for conversation, friendship, intimacy, connection, and then from there, the capacity for community and participation in society. This is the thing, because I think this is the thing where we're being too simplistic in our thinking about where our devices are hurting us. Many people say to me, okay, I see Turkle is saying, I see she's saying that when I'm with my friends, put away the phone, I shouldn't have it out when I'm together with people. It's bad for conversation. But why does she care if when I'm alone, I'm on my phone all the time? I mean, like, sort of, what is it her business? She cares about relationship, but what does she care if I have my phone with me all the time when I'm alone? And I do. I'm that much of a busybody. I do make that connection. And here is the connection, is that the capacity for solitude, which is the most signal, the most important development of childhood, the psychoanalytic tradition says something fabulous. It says, if you don't teach your children to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. In other words, linking the capacity to be alone and to know how to gather yourself in solitude with the capacity to be with other people. It's the capacity to be alone and to have a moment of solitude that allows you, when somebody else comes along, to actually listen to what they have to say, to see them as a separate person, and to hear them. Instead of when somebody else comes along, and if you can't stand to be alone with yourself, kind of glomming on to them and trying to make them into who you need them to be in order to feel less desperate when you're alone. So the capacity for solitude and the capacity for friendship and mutuality go together so intimately. That's the piece that I think is the most important message of my work, is thinking, and of Thoreau's brilliant one chair for solitude, two chairs for friendship, three chairs for society. It's that virtuous circle between solitude, friendship, community that we really need to remember, and that our phones, you know, I mean, our devices, our relationships with our devices are actually disrupting. And actually, right now, the disruption in the virtuous circle is beginning with a disruption in solitude. There's a recent study that, I mean, to make a terrible pun, is shocking. You ask college students, okay, we want you to sit, we want you to sit without a phone, without a laptop, without a tablet, for 6 to 15 minutes. Are you good with that? Yeah. Okay, during that time, do you think you might want to electroshock yourself? No. Nobody says, that's shocking, that's ridiculous. Of course not. So people are asked to just sit without anything, you know, just kind of sit. And after 6 minutes, there is an electroshock machine there, and people are starting to give themselves electroshocks rather than sit quietly with their thoughts. It's less incredible if you do the kind of research I do, where you sit at stop signs and watch how people behave in the 4 seconds that they are at a stop sign, where they take out their phones and they start to read their texts and start to do texting and email. In other words, 4 seconds of just being alone with their thoughts at a stop sign is more than most people can handle. So there is something about our inability to just sit without a device that is really plaguing us now. And this is where the virtuous circle breaks down. We struggle to pay attention to ourselves, and what suffers is our ability to pay attention to each other. We want to be with each other, but also elsewhere, connected to wherever we want to be. And I see a fascinating example of this when I interview college students who talk to me about what they call the rule of three. So I told you about the rule of seven, which is it takes 7 minutes to kind of figure out if you're happy with a conversation. Here's the rule of three. So the rule of three is you go out to dinner with a bunch of friends, and everybody wants to text during dinner. That's a given. You don't want to, you're going to bring your phone, you're going to text, you're going to keep up on your social media. But you also want to be with your friends at dinner. So the rule of three is that three people have to have their heads up talking before you feel comfortable putting your head down to look at your phone. I see a lot of people going like this because most people unconsciously obey the rule of three. So what happens in that kind of conversation is conversation is going to be kept light on topics where people feel they can drop in and out, and you don't make much of a connection. That is a recipe for not developing intimacy, for not developing empathy. And when people say to me, you know, what's the big production? What's wrong with texting? I want to just say for the record, since this has been, I think, a common, you know, misperception of what I'm writing about and what my message about is about, is that the group of college students who I was with who first told me about the rule of three, one of the young men in that group said to me, there's nothing wrong with texting. Professor Terkel, don't study texting. Texting is great. It's what texting is doing to our friendships when we're with each other. That's the problem. In other words, there's nothing wrong with texting. Texting is fun. Texting is erotic. Texting is sexy. Texting is rich and poetic. And I mean, texting is, this is a new genre. There's nothing wrong with texting, and I'm a great appreciator of this new genre. It's the way we are using texting to keep us from paying attention to each other when we are together with each other. That's what I'm identifying as the problem. That's very different from saying, you know, I hate texting, or I don't like texting, or texting is bad, or get rid of this new texting. So let me give you an example. If I was up here and I said to you, you know, hey, just sit tight. I just want to have a book. I have Madame Bovary with me. And I just like want to take a minute and read like a few chapters and be with Emma and Charles Bovary for like a minute or two, and I'll just get back to you. You would like, it would be odd to take a book in a conversation or in the middle of a lecture and, you know, just like say, excuse me. But people all the time in the middle of conversations take out a phone and just say, hold on, just sit tight a second. I just need to do this. So it's the social mores that have grown up around how we use our phones that I'm pointing to, that I'm talking about, and that I'm trying to say those are the problems. It isn't the texting itself or the phone itself or anything that we're, you know, the things that we're doing on the phones. We need new etiquettes and new social mores around the phones because we're doing crazy things with our phones. There are baby bouncers that have a slot for an iPad or an iPad. You know, it's that's not right. There are potty trainers that have a slot for an iPad. That's not right. That's not good for child development. These are moments when you need eye contact with the child. It doesn't make sense to have these sorts of things at those moments in the developmental cycle of a child. So I've been talking here about the conversations of Thoreau's first and second chair, the conversations of solitude and friendship and family, but I want to just end with a few words on Thoreau's third chair, the conversations of society, business, and politics. So first let me just say a word about work. Studies make it clear that at work, conversation is good for the bottom line. When employees have their breaks together, productivity jumps up, and yet so many people think that they're only being productive when they're sitting at their screens answering their email. When you ask them, they say, that's when I'm being productive. And they're wrong. Bringing conversation back into the workplace, face-to-face conversation, is the future of work. It is not the past of work. And that is just something that really, that job of showing the research and explaining that and making that point is really the work ahead. And it's not easy, because I've studied companies where new recruits are truly phone phobic. In one business, new recruits don't want to talk on the phone, and staff members are told to check when new hires say they have talked to clients. Have they actually talked with their voice to clients, like with their mouth to clients? Because usually a millennial will say, I have talked to somebody when they've texted to somebody. And in a business situation, talking and texting and email do not do the same kind of work. Very few will use the phone unless specifically instructed to do so. And yet, face-to-face conversation is what builds trust. It's where the deal finally gets done. So let me end on those most important third chair conversations, those of politics, very much on our minds these days. We've long known how important public conversations are to democracy. They've been town squares and town meetings, clubs, coffee houses, and salons. And what they've had in common is that they've been a place to talk about politics and also to learn how to talk about politics. And historically, and this is very important, they've been a place where people went to talk to people they disagreed with. And in contrast, recent studies show that when people go online, they don't want to share opinions that they think their followers won't approve of. It's called the spiral of silence. And students will actually avoid talking about politics face to face with those who disagree with them, even if the students with other views live right down the hall. So this is not something that just happens online. This is a problem of kind of cocooning that happens online and off. But here too, I'm hopeful. I mean, look at us here. We come to places such as this to have public conversations. We thirst for this. We want to learn from each other. We hunger for something that technology can actually help us with, which is the opportunity to change our minds. So what are the first steps in how technology can help us change our minds? I see a couple. They're not easy. First of all, remember that the presence of a device already signals that your attention is elsewhere, even if you don't intend it to be. It will limit the conversation in those two ways. First, more trivial. Second, less empathic connection. So rich conversations have difficulty competing with even a silent phone. To clear a path for conversation, set aside laptops, set aside tablets, put away the phone. I say create sacred spaces in classrooms. 5 years ago, faculty, when I polled them and about, you know, cell phones and tablets and laptops in classrooms, they said, I don't want to be anybody's nanny. Students should do whatever they want to do. Now faculty have read the research, they've had the experience. More and more we say, just put away your devices. It's just not a good idea. Pay attention to your classmates. Pay attention to me. Let's have a conversation. This is no longer kind of a crazy, you know, Luddite thing to do in a classroom. Create sacred spaces at home and at work, starting with the kitchen, the dining room, the car. The car is ground zero in the fight to reclaim conversation. Significant meetings. Meetings. Reclaim meetings. Meetings are not a place for email. Meetings are a place to be with each other. Second, design for conversation. We are vulnerable to multitasking. Many people go to meetings, they sit down, whoa, it's a meeting. They open up their laptop or tablet, they start to do their email. Not a good idea. We're vulnerable. Create meetings that are really meetings and make them shorter. Admit that you're vulnerable, but make them meetings. Very, very important. Cultivate solitude. I've said a lot about this. It really is the first step to cultivating conversation. Obey the 7-minute rule. Give people a chance. You have to let something unfold and not go to your phone before those minutes pass. If there is a lull in a conversation, let it be. It is often when we are silent or stumble or skip our words that we reveal ourselves most to each other. Let it be. We've gotten used to what we sound like online, you know, always perfect, always present. And in present, we're not like that. Let it be. Stay proactive. Technology is not a given. I like to say that just because we grew up with the internet, we think the internet is all grown up. It is not. It is early days. We are still making this culture. We are still making this technology, the technology of our dreams, what we need it to be for us. As I said, develop the social mores around this technology that will work for us. The fundamental message of reclaiming conversation is that we've gotten ourselves into trouble together, across the generations, and that we're ready to find our way out of trouble. Remember that empathy gap. It's not just young people. That empathy gap is for everybody. Remember that conversation can cure it. So look up, look at each other, and let's start the conversation. Thank you.
You've been listening to Reclaiming Conversation with MIT Professor Sherry Turkle, a Cambridge Forum event at the First Parish in Harvard Square. We are co-sponsored by the Massachusetts Cultural Council, the Lowell Institute, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. This is Mary Stack. Thanks for listening.